This podcast is made possible by listeners who can contribute now at thestory.org and in collaboration by Burt's Bees, Red Hat, and the Redwoods Group Foundation, who believe by working together we can help strengthen communities for a better world.
Jean Dominique grew up in Haiti under the rule of the Duvaliers and in the chaotic days when their successor, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was in power. These days, while Haitians are supposed to be working their way towards a new government, the old dictator, Jean-Claude Duvalier, has returned, and any day it's expected Aristide will also come back from exile. Jean Dominique brings an unusual perspective to what lies ahead. Her father was once one of the most respected journalists in Haiti, and ultimately he was assassinated for his work. Jean worked alongside her father at his radio station, but when the assassins later came after her mother, she said, "Ça suffit, that's enough." She left Haiti. But Jean still has the clear eye and the insight of her days at the forefront of the fight for human rights in Haiti, and she is still in that fight. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
Support for The Story comes from Red Hat, an enterprise open source company that works within communities to create technology the open source way. RedHat.com.
This story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced by American Public Media.
Coming up later in the program, the story of a T-shirt that raises questions of political correctness in preschool. But first, to a woman whose family played such a key role in the recent history of Haiti. A month ago, Jean-Claude Duvalier, the former dictator known as Baby Doc, rattled Haitians with his surprise return. Jean Dominique has been watching from her home in Montreal, and I invited her to talk with me about her memories of life under the different Haitian regimes. And because Jean slips back and forth between French and English, we have also arranged to have an interpreter with us. When I talked with Jean, she had just attended a meeting of Haitians in Montreal, and she says she could feel their anger.
Some was speaking about more than justice, more violent than justice. But we told the person that we need to go to a real trial. We hope it's possible. You see, I don't know if s'il y aura des résultats.
I don't know if there will be results.
Mais on peut
but
pas
we cannot leave things this way.
S'il n'y a pas de punition,
if there's no punishment for the crimes, they're going to happen again.
In Haiti, impunity is the biggest problem.
Jean Dominique was 4 years old when François Duvalier, the father of Jean-Claude, became president. At that time, no one spoke about politics. It was far too dangerous. The dictators were well protected by their feared paramilitary, the Tonton Macoute. Jean went to the same school as the dictator's son, the man who'd later become known as Baby Doc. And she was there on the day when someone tried to kidnap him.
And that morning, it was very terrifying for me because when I arrive, I go to school on my feet.
On foot, yes.
On foot. And when I arrive at the corner of my school, the car was here and people shooting. And I don't understand what happened. And a guy just take me and put me on the sidewalk to protect me. He covered my body to protect me. And after the shooting, when everything is calm, he just take my hand and go to the school with me. And after that, 1 or 2 hours after, my father came and bring me at home. But after that, they cannot... ils ne pouvaient pas empêcher que les enfants écoutent.
They couldn't prevent children from hearing.
And if I'm not mistaken, Jean, after that attempt to kidnap the young man who would later become Baby Doc Duvalier, after that attempt to kidnap him, there was a horrible crackdown in Port-au-Prince, and a lot of people were arrested and beaten.
Yes, that's what I said. They cannot...
They couldn't hide the children from that at that point.
They cannot do that. We know, you know, because it was all the streets, you know, fighting, burning house and killing people. We saw people dead on the street. So they cannot tell us that nothing happened.
And when you would ask your father, you know, Papa, what's going on? Why is this happening? What would he say to you?
I was 10 years old, so he told me there is a...
He told me that it's a catastrophe.
That was the first time he told me they are killing people without reason.
Jen, did you know Jean-Claude in school?
No, I just saw him in front of my house because he had a friend in that house just the other side of the street. And I just saw him. But, you know, my father always told me, when he's there, don't go outside. Stay inside. I don't want him to see you. Because, you know, when a young girl, when a totomakut like a young girl, you cannot do anything. And I have a girlfriend that the parents put in a plane and
sent them out of the country.
Yes, leave the country because they were the totomakut need to be a boyfriend or something like that.
You were in school in Canada when Jean-Claude Duvalier, Baby Doc, became president for life. Is that right?
Yes.
Do you remember watching that on television?
Yes, and I remember my stepfather telling me, you know, he's the same age as you.
19 years old, right?
19 years old. And I said, wow. He said, do you think you can be president of Haiti? I said, no, really no. And it was amazing to see that.
But what were you thinking about your country at that time? You must have been feeling some despair about the future.
Yes, but, you know, it was the beginning for my father, the beginning of his fighting. And I was sad, but j'avais de l'espoir aussi.
I had hope too.
You cannot kill the truth. You cannot kill justice. You cannot kill what we are fighting for. Participation of the citizen to the community business. You cannot kill that.
That's the voice of Jean-Dominique's father, Jean. He was the visionary journalist immortalized in the documentary film The Agronomist. He's the man who first tried to bring accurate reporting to the people through Radio Haiti. In the late 70s, Jean-Dominique was in that radio station as well, with her father, Jean.
You know, it was full of hope because we were trying to do something. It was under the dictatorship of Jean-Claude Duvalier, but we tried to do something.
And so when you worked side by side with your father, your stepmother, Michelle, she was there at the same time?
Yes, yes.
It must have been a wonderful time, though, for the three of you. Michelle, the journalist, your father, the wild activist, you, the young journalist. What was that like for you?
Oh, pour moi, c'était...
Oh, for me, it was my whole life.
J'avais trouvé une façon...
I had found a way to help my country and the poorest of my country.
You're listening to The Story. Human rights activists and labor groups were agitating for change, and Radio Haiti had become a kind of loudspeaker for those movements. Now, this was another time when U.S. politics played into Haitian affairs, because it was soon after the election of Ronald Reagan in November 1980 when Duvalier felt confident enough that he could crack down on the radio station. Jean-Dominique and his wife Michelle described what happened in the film The Agronomist.
Soldiers shooting at a mixer, shooting at a record player, you know, smashing with their machine gun. They broke a lot.
We heard them breaking things inside. The station was no longer on the air. Everyone, all of Haiti, could hear only a very strange sound, a tuck. That you hear when the record is stuck.
I think that it was strange. There is no operator at the radio. What happened? And I go to Radio Haiti to see what happened. And when I arrive, the radio was full of military, was for of soldiers, and I was arrested. And all the people who were in the radio, everyone was arrested.
Where did they take you?
At the Caserne des Salines. It was where
political
prisoners
were taken, right?
Yes.
And Jan, while you were there, did you see people who were being mistreated or people who had been held for a long period of time?
I don't see them. I heard them. People crying. People yelling. You know, when I was out after 2 or 3 days, and when I speak to friends after that, you know, after weeks and months, I realized that some friend of us in Radio Haiti, 2 of them, were tortured.
Those must have been difficult days, the final years of Jean-Claude Duvalier's time.
Yes, but after a moment, it was very, very hopeful because young people start fighting, you know. There were meeting of young people. There were Catholic priests.
Well, this was the very beginning of the movement that would put Aristide into power, right?
Yes, but it was first the movement who kicked out Jean-Claude Duvalier. You know, people fight for that.
Do you remember the day that he left?
Oh, yes. Oh, all the people in the street, dancing, singing, you know.
And were you there with them, dancing and singing?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Jan's father, Jean-Dominique, went into exile on the day that Radio Haiti was ransacked. He was gone 6 years, and it was only after Jean-Claude Duvalier left that he returned, and 60,000 people greeted Jan's father at the airport. It was to be the beginning of the next chapter for her in Haitian politics, one that began with the rule of Aristide and ended with the killing of her father. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. And that's the sound of a radio station that doesn't exist anymore. Radio Haiti was once a leading force in the fight for free expression, but it was crushed under Duvalier and again by the military in the years after that. Jan Dominique worked there. She says those were the greatest and the most hope-filled days of her life. These days, Jan is not so sure. Though Haitians are supposed to be preparing for next month's presidential election, the political water is being muddied by the return of 2 former leaders. The dictator, Baby Doc Duvalier, is already there, and the exiled, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, is expected any day. Now, Jan's pretty good with English, but she's most comfortable speaking French, so we do have an interpreter. One of the reasons Jan feels so connected to Haitian history is that she lived it at the front of the crowd. She worked alongside her father, the renowned journalist Jean-Dominique. When he came back from exile, she went to the airport to meet him, a moment documented in the movie The Agronomist.
I don't know why, but after 6 years, the Haitian people remember. And it was a very wonderful day for me, because more than 60,000 people went to greet us.
He didn't realize that people remember him.
It was an incredible scene. Could you get close to him at that time, Jan?
Oh, no. I was afraid. Because after I kissed him, people came from everywhere, and I que j'allais étouffer.
I had the impression that I was going to be smothered.
Après ça, il y a quelqu'un qui m'a pris sur ses épaules.
After that, someone took me on his shoulders.
Et m'a amené dans la voiture.
And took me to the car where my father was.
And did that feeling of hope come back at that time?
Oh, yes. You know, We thought that everything can be. We can do a lot of things. And tout était possible.
Everything was possible.
I hear a sadness in your voice.
Ouais. Parce que j'ai l'impression
yes,
que
because I feel that many things were not done as they should have been.
N'ont pas été faites comme il fallait.
In 1991, Haitians chose their first democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. But just months later, he was ousted in a coup. Jeanne Dominique and her family had been supporters of Aristide, but they became increasingly disillusioned with Haitian politics. Her father, Jean Dominique, with Michel Montas at his side, continued to speak critically about politics on the radio. He also took on corruption in business. It was on April 3, 2000, that his powerful voice was silenced. Jean was shot 4 times in the chest as he arrived for work that morning at the radio station.
You know, at the radio, my father and Michel had a program at 7 o'clock in the morning. And when they go to vacation or something like that, I am the one who take the show.
Take over for them, yeah.
Yes. So I don't like to wake up early in the morning. And every time when they are not in the radio station, encore. So this morning, I receive a telephone, someone telling me that my father had an accident and I had to call at the radio station. And I imagined that it was just a car accident or something, and I had to take the program at 7 o'clock. So I just take my car, and when I was at the street, I saw ambulance coming. And I don't realize what it was. And someone called me. I had a radio, you know, in my car. And someone tell me, it's not necessary to come at the radio station. Go to the hospital. Now I realize that something wrong happened. And when I arrive at the hospital, I saw him. And I asked the doctor, what are you doing? Just take care of him. But it was too late. And I just asked Michel, please stay with me. Without you, I can't do anything. And she promised me. She said yes, because before that, one time when we was talking, she said, if your father died, I go with him. And I remember that when I realized he was dead. And I said, Michel, stay with me, please. That's what I remember. And I remember, too, when the two presidents came, Aristide and Préval. Both of them was at the hospital. Both of them was at the funeral, too.
And were you thinking at that time, John, that those men could have prevented this, could have saved your father's life if they cared enough to do that?
You know, Préval told my father, pay attention. And a guy in the police told him, do you want a bodyguard? And my father told, I don't want a bodyguard. Parce que qui me gardera de mon gardien?
Who would guard me from my bodyguard?
Because he always told us, if they want to kill me, they would.
Jan, after your father was killed, did you think about leaving Haiti?
No.
Why did you stay?
Because we need to fight for justice. We thought that if a man like Jean, who is known, you know, all over Haiti and outside of Haiti, who had a radio station we can fight with, if he cannot have justice, anybody can have justice. And during 3 years, we fight every day for that.
You know, I ask you this question because I think I probably would have given up. If I, like you, had been a child under both Duvalier regimes and then seen all the coups and the upset around the time of Aristide, and then had my father, who was a spokesman for human rights, shot in front of the radio station, I think I would have said, you know, I give up on this country. There's nothing to be done.
No, I thought, you know, I thought that we cannot give up. We had to do that. We had to try. And we decided to leave Haiti after an attempt against Michel. Not only Michel, but two of our journalists. It was the 25th of December, Christmas, and after the dinner, she went back to her house, and two people were waiting for her. They don't kill her, but they killed her driver. And after that, they go to the house of two of our journalists. Ils les ont menacés.
They threatened them. Because we were continuing to demand justice every day. And we were pressuring the judges and the senators.
Les sénateurs et les députés. Donc, quand on s'est rendu compte qu'ils allaient s'attaquer.
When we realized that they were going to attack our journalists, we couldn't stand it.
C'est à ce moment-là qu'on a décidé de partir.
And it was at that moment that we decided to leave.
That was about 7 years ago now, right?
Yes.
Have you ever been back since then?
Yeah, sometimes to see family, to, you know, but 1 week, 4 days.
Do you ever
think? Because I'm not in exile.
No, I understand that. Do you think even now about possibly going back to be a part of rebuilding Haiti?
Someone asked me that question, and I said, what can I do now? I don't have my radio station anymore. The radio is the building, you know. The building collapsed during the
earthquake.
And I don't want to come back in Haiti to, I don't know, to make a life like... to open a restaurant or, you know, art gallery or something like that? No.
Does anything pull at you as the daughter of Jean Dominique and Michel Montes? Does anything pull at you, though, to be a part of the change in Haiti? If this is a time, I realize how many times you have been disappointed in the past, but I wonder if anything is pulling at you now.
Now, today.
Yes, ma'am.
I want to bring Jean-Claude Duvalier in jail. That's what do me, you know.
That's what keeps
you
going.
C'est ce qui me fait bouger maintenant.
Yeah, that's what makes me move right now.
Jeanne Dominique belongs to a well-known Haitian family. She and her father Jean and her stepmother Michel Montes were for years at the front of the fight for civil rights there. You're listening to The Story. Jeanne is currently doing what she can to organize Haitians in Montreal to lodge a formal complaint against the former dictator Jean-Claude Duvalier, Baby Doc, to punish him for the abuses that occurred during his presidency. Michel Montes is one of those behind a lawsuit in Haiti. And now, another of Haiti's former presidents may be returning to the country. Years ago, Jeanne Dominique was a supporter of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, but no longer.
I think Aristide think he can return to power. I think that.
Does he stand a chance?
Oh, it will be terrible if that happened, because, you know, il a déçu tellement de
monde. He disappointed so many people.
Et
the period during which he was in power, he did not make the things happen that he promised.
And no second chances?
Je ne sais pas.
I don't know.
Est-ce que les gens
do people want to give him a second chance?
Moi, je n'y aurais pas donné cette
I would not have given him that second chance.
Tell me something else, Jen. When you look at what's happening with politics in Haiti now, the first presidential election, which was a disaster, and now another one, which is coming up, they at least have two candidates. Can they get this right this time?
Je ne sais pas.
I don't know.
Dans la famille, c'était mon
père. In my family, it was my father who understood politics.
Et c'est pourquoi il me manque.
And that's why I miss him the most.
Parce que quand je ne comprends pas.
Because when I don't understand, there's no one who can explain it to me.
Jen, do you have nightmares about your time in Haiti?
Tous les soirs.
Every night.
Tous les soirs, je rêve d'Haïti.
Every night I dream of Haiti. Sometimes it's nightmares.
Nightmare.
Sometimes not, but every night I dream of Haiti.
C'est comme si je vivais à Montréal.
It's as though I live in Montreal, but a part of me is in Haiti.
Do you still have hope that Haiti can find some kind of balance, some kind of peace?
I want to think that. I want that, you know, because my generation... We had no energy, probably, to fight, continuing. But I think the young people can do that. And I talked to someone in Haiti 2 days ago, and young people are fighting. Some of them. They are thinking about the problems, you know, they are talking about the problems, they are trying to understand what happened, and that's my hope.
That they will fight for the country.
Yes, for the change.
Hey, yo, I ain't gonna never forget Jean-Dominique, man. The kids gotta know what really happened, man. Why, Clef, man.
Jen Dominique joined me from the studios of the CBC in Montreal. We have a link to a novel she wrote about her years under dictatorship in Haiti. It's on our website. That's at thestory.org. And thanks today to Nina Furry, who was our interpreter for the program. You're listening to The Story. It seems we've talked a lot about dictators on the program lately. I spoke last month with a woman who was exploring her connection to a brutal regime in Chile. General Augusto Pinochet seized control there in 1973, and my guest, Paulina, was disturbed to find out, and not too long ago, that her father likely played a part in the terror that went on in that country. He was a naval officer when the coup occurred.
I always understood that my dad wouldn't like to talk about the coup. It was a very painful memory for him. Whatever he saw, I thought, or heard or witnessed, and you just don't bring that up. And my parents never brought the issue up at home.
After that story aired, a woman named Jennifer called into our open mic line. Seems she found a secret in her own family.
At the tone, please record your message.
When I was a young girl in Switzerland, I was an exchange student. My parents came to visit. We decided to rent a car and go to Germany. One thing led to another, and my father couldn't resist going and knocking on the door of the German distant relative. And the families were very excited to see each other, lots of exchange of information. And she pulls out photo albums. And there is this man who, in every picture had looked so similar to my father and to myself again and again, and their wedding day and very happy, delightful family reunion. And of course, here he is in his Nazi uniform. I don't know how to describe it. It stunned all of us, although there was no reason it should have. It was the most obvious, natural thing that a young man in his 20s, in the 40s, who was strong and healthy, would have been recruited for the armed forces.
Thanks, Jennifer. These personal stories about the impact of political change seem ever more relevant today. If you have a moment to talk to me about one story about how political turmoil affected you, you can call our open mic line at 1-888-966-9862. Coming up next on the program, a mother learns that just putting any old T-shirt on her 2-year-old son can have repercussions. This was a Che Guevara shirt, and that story is next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Images can have tremendous power. Think of the banners of Lenin in Red Square or the portraits of Mao Zedong on the walls in China. Then there are the T-shirts, millions of them. They come with the faces of Mandela and Bob Marley or Gandhi. One well-known image is that of the Cuban guerrilla leader Ernesto Che Guevara. One of our regular contributors, the writer Krista Bremer, had an unexpected run-in with that image. It started on a business trip in New York City.
And I realized at the end of the day that I had not gotten a gift for my children. And I passed a street vendor who was selling these T-shirts that had pop icons on the front of them. And I thought this would be a great gift for my kids, sort of hip, edgy, irreverent T-shirts from the city. And I selected for my daughter a T-shirt with Albert Einstein on the front, sticking out his tongue. And for my son, I selected a shirt with Che Guevara's image on the front. And my son at this time was about 2 years old. So when I returned home, I gave my kids these gifts, and they loved them. And the next day was a Monday, and they decided to wear these shirts to school. And as we were driving my son to his Spanish immersion daycare, my daughter was teaching him how to say Che Guevara. And we thought this was really funny. You know, he was sitting in the back saying Che Guevara, Che Guevara. And we'd ask him, who's on your shirt? And he would say Che Guevara. And he was really proud of himself. So when he got to his school, he ran up to his teacher, who is a soft-spoken Cuban woman, who's just was really wonderful with him and had a good rapport with him. And he ran up to her pointing to his T-shirt and saying, Che Guevara. And I happened to be looking at her, and I saw her react with a look of shock. And then I saw her mask that and kneel down and compliment him on his shirt and give him a hug and welcome him to class, just as she always did. But this initial reaction that she had really baffled me. I just had no idea where it came from. But that afternoon, when my husband went to pick up our son, she pulled him aside and said that she wanted to talk to him. My husband is from Libya, and this teacher, whose name was Maria, told him that it was so shocking for her to see my, you know, sort of cherub-like son. You know, he's this chubby-cheeked, curly-headed little 2-year-old. She said to see the image of Che Guevara on his shirt was as disturbing to her as it might be for us if we had seen a cute little toddler with Osama bin Laden's face imprinted on his T-shirt. And she went on to say that Che Guevara was actually, a very brutal, force in Cuba, and that he was responsible for the deaths of many people, and that he was actually as brutal to his people as Gaddafi was to the Libyans. And this was a vivid comparison for my husband, who had moved to the United States in order to get as far as he could from Gaddafi's brutal policies. So my husband came home and he told me about this conversation, and I was shocked. And I felt ashamed too, because I have a degree in journalism, and I like to think that I am not taken in by propaganda. But I had to admit that I knew very little about Che Guevara. When my husband told me about this conversation, I realized that I sort of had this image of him as a romantic revolutionary leader, and also, to be honest, as a handsome face that I had seen in a movie recently on a motorcycle. And that maybe I had confused this actor that I had seen with the reality of somebody's life. So the next day when I dropped my son off, I pulled the teacher aside, and I told her that I wanted to know more about her perspective. I asked her what her feelings were about Che Guevara. And she, very emotionally, she told me about some dear friends of hers who had been executed at a prison that was run by Che Guevara. And she also said, please don't feel bad. I understand that a lot of Americans are misled by the propaganda in this country about Che Guevara. And that comment really got under my skin, because I certainly don't like to think of myself as a victim of propaganda. So I went to work, and I immediately did a Google search to try to get some more information about Che Guevara. And, I immediately got something like 400,000 hits about Che Guevara and oppression and murder. And I learned that his vision of liberating the Cuban people included the execution of his opposition. And that opposition included Cuba's upper classes as well as the intellectuals. And I also learned that he had run an infamous prison in Cuba called La Cabana, and that thousands of people had been tortured and executed in this prison. And then I took another look at this T-shirt that I had given my son, and all of a sudden I really could see the similarities between this image of Che Guevara on this T-shirt and the images that I had seen of Gaddafi when I had recently visited Libya. And, there's a way that the photo was taken so that you feel as if you are looking at this person from far below them. And it gives them sort of an all-powerful sense in the photo. And there's also these exaggeratedly handsome features that I saw on Gaddafi's images everywhere in Tripoli. And when I realized this similarity, I just could not believe that I hadn't noticed this before and that I hadn't questioned my own associations with Che Guevara. So I guess, the experience for me was one of realizing that, in this country, even with my own intention to educate myself, I can still fall victim to misrepresentations or limited understanding, especially of world politics, I guess.
Krista Bremer is a writer in North Carolina with The Sun magazine. You're listening to The Story. A woman named Gerda Weissman-Klein will be at the White House today. President Obama is awarding her the 2010 Presidential Medal of Freedom. The award is for her work to teach tolerance to children and to combat the issue of hunger in the Americas. Now, Gerda knows a lot about tolerance and hunger. She survived 6 years of Nazi cruelty. Her parents were killed in Auschwitz. She lost her brother in the war. She was in the labor camps and watched her closest friends die on a death march, a march that started out with some 4,000 women, which only 120 survived. And though her experience was horrifying, Gerda also remembers wonderful acts of decency, testaments to the human spirit. And though she's now in her late 80s, she still travels the country to talk with young people. And I had a chance to talk with Gerda a few years back.
I was on the death march, and we started with 4,000 girls, and then were divided in two groups of 2,000, and of this number, fewer than 120 survived. And the miraculous thing happened. It's the first American who entered our camp, blessedly became my husband.
The one thing that you bring to young people, Gerda, is your story, is the experience that you've been through. What's the part of your story, the surviving of the Holocaust, the surviving of the death march, the meeting of your husband at the end of the war, what's the part of your story that you find gets through to kids today?
I really don't know, but I will tell you that a lot of the male has always reflected one particular story. And that is a story of a childhood friend of mine. And people identify with her. Her name was Ilse. And I tell them I didn't particularly like her because my mother always told me how perfect she was, how she played the piano, how neat she was and all that. And I hated to play with her. And when in the camps, we became sisters to each other. She once found a raspberry and she kept it in her pocket against all temptation to give it to me that night on a leaf. She never ate another raspberry again. She died in my arms on the death march. She told me she wasn't angry at anyone. She asked me that if her parents and her little sister Kitty survive, not to tell them how she died. They didn't survive. And lastly, she asked me to promise to go on for one more week. A week in those days was a very long time. A week later, I was liberated by my husband. I hear from a lot of young girls, and they have sent me raspberries and pictures of raspberries, that people can understand this very young girl who died at age 18. But if you have a chance, or anybody has a chance to be in Boston, down there at Haymarket is a memorial of 6 columns, and one of them is Ilse's story, giving me the raspberry. And I always say, you know, Hitler with all his power, there's no monument to him. We saw Saddam Hussein's monument tumbling to the dust. In our country, we have monuments to goodness. And sad as it is, it's very comforting to know that.
Gerda, you've had a lot of time to think about this, and I'm curious to know what you'd say to this question. Why is it that a story, whether it's the story of Ilse and the raspberry or your story of surviving the Holocaust, why is it that stories have the power that they do to actually change people, to inspire people?
It must be somehow rooted in fairy tales, you know, where goodness always, you know, towers over evil, you know. And I suppose, you know, there's a dark side to it as well, that stories of horror and things like that are to those who are so inclined build their imagination to commit horror.
You mean we can't recognize goodness unless we know what evil looks like?
Perhaps. You know, I'm not Pollyanna.
No, I understand that. And I remain puzzled why it is that you and others like you have to keep telling the story of tolerance, as if you stop telling the story, things would get even worse. You know what I mean?
Well,
you know, I'll tell you, I've been very encouraged lately. Maybe I'm stupid, but, you know, it's the end of my life now. And
stupid,
you know,
is not a word that I would use to describe.
No, but it's the truth. I mean, you know, and I'd like to be able to sort of go out and feel that my children and grandchildren and all the children are inheriting a good world, you know, that there isn't this horrible things. You know, I brought children to this world for what? For suffering? I mean, come on. My beloved husband always said that pain should not be wasted, that pain should be shared. And, you know, we were called after the tragedy at Columbine. So Quet and I went to Columbine. And I saw those wounded kids, and I held them in my arms. And, you know, and they asked me, will I ever laugh again? Will I ever be happy again? And for me to think that, you know, so many years later, more than half a century later, there will be two disarranged young men. They will be planning how to kill them on Hitler's birthday in honor of Hitler.
Did you ever figure out, Gerda, why that kind of hatred, why that kind of sadness can take root in a school like the one in Columbine?
I don't know.
Can you turn it around?
I don't know. I'm trying. I know it's stupid. But one cannot give up, you know. It's the old story of the seahorses on the beach, you know, if you can help one.
How old are you now, Gerda?
82, but right now I feel like 95.
Why?
Because I'm sad, but ultimately in history, and I've always been a student of history, in recorded history till now, goodness has triumphed over evil. And I hope it will.
You just hope, or you think?
I pray for it.
Gerda, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We recorded that conversation with Gerda Weissman-Klein 5 years ago. She is scheduled to be awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom today. And you can find out more about her foundation and about the classroom kit that's based on her experiences. We have those links at our website at thestory.org. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll have the stories of several soldiers who are serving in Iraq and the music that they brought with them on their iPods.
Sergeant Crystal Halbert from Manhattan, Kansas, 26 years old.
Another summer day has come and gone away in Paris and Rome, but I want to go home.
Home by Blake Shelton. I can relate to it because it talks about being surrounded by so many people, but you just want to go home because you still feel all alone.
Feel all alone. I want to go home. Oh, I miss you.
Soldiers and their iPods. That's coming up tomorrow. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
That I wrote to you. Each one a line or two. I'm fine, baby, how are you? I would send them, but I know that it's just not enough. My words were cold and flat, and you deserve more than that. Another airplane, another sunny place. I'm lucky, I know, but I want to go home. Go home. Let me go home.
Support for The Story comes from the Redwoods Group Foundation, encouraging social entrepreneurs to explore Durham, North Carolina's transformation into a nexus for social enterprise. BullCityForward.org.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.